September 20th, 1967. This is the second class of the course at Fordham University with McLuhan and Harley Parker and Ted Carpenter and John Colkin. We heard last week, September 18th, the inaugural class. Now this is 2 days later.
So Dr. Carpenter will start off, and then we'll discuss from the platform and then take questions from the group. Ted?
That should be comfortable.
All right, fine. Well, now, perhaps the sensible way for us to have begun would have been with certain general statements and slowly introduce you to the subject. But I prefer to simply parachute into an area, to say go off to a primitive tribe without any preparation whatsoever, and find myself living among natives and being forced to find out, to understand what's going on. Now, I want to parachute with you today right into a major difference, and that is the way native peoples use their senses. It's not enough for us to say that they are concerned with sight or that they smell and so forth. They will have different sensory orders. Let me give you a very simple illustration of this. If a child is born without arms or legs, he cannot perceive in three dimensions. But when he takes his hand and runs it along the table here, or more probably along his thigh, and discovers that there is depth, then he sees depth. But if he's born without, if he's a basket case, then he can never see in three dimensions. Now, the point I wish to make then is that there is a different world that is available to those who use senses in a different way. If you isolate your senses, you will experience the world in one way. And if you have sensory interpenetration and sensory interplay, there is actually another world in which you participate. Now, man inherited a very curious sensory order. I mean genetically inherited it. We are descended from shrew-like creatures, those tarsiers and lemurs, that you see at the zoo, and if you'll recall, they both have bulbous eyes. They both have pop eyes. Now, they are shrew-like creatures who inhabited the uppermost branches of trees, and they possessed bird-like powers of sight and hearing, but they suffered a corresponding loss of sensitivity in their chemical receptors. In other words, they have superb sight. They have the sight of birds. They have the acute hearing of birds, but they smell very little and taste even less. The sense of smell in some animals is so acute that if I were to take a certain species of moth and place it here in the Bronx in a heavy smog period at night and release a male 3 miles distant, within about 3 hours, the male would reach the female by the power of smell alone. Well, of course, we don't have any power of smell or taste or touch that remotely approaches this. And to added to this, literate man put on a cultural insult. He degraded scent and savor. He scorned the tactile. He called painters and poets and musicians artists, but cooks and gardeners and hairdressers were seldom more than servants. Now, by contrast, primitive man will upgrade those senses. Where we will culturally downgrade them, he upgrades them. And thus he achieves a sensory balance and orchestration which nature had denied us genetically. Now, primitive man will do this in many ways, but I think his deepest mode of expression of achieving the sensory orchestration is by ritual. And this encourages this interpenetration and interplay of the senses. And it allows the tribal artist, who may be equally gifted as musician and poet and dancer, it allows him to combine these talents. Under literacy, however, ritual fell into disfavor. Literate man developed separate art forms. If I want to know about poetry, I don't go to Picasso. And if I want to know about music, I don't go to Pound. Each art became a private means of expression and experience. And so we finally developed that world in which the concert goer closes his eyes, the museum guard warns, do not touch, and the librarian posts a sign, silence. Now, the predominance of the eye under literacy left very little room for the other senses. You know, when the teacher imposes discipline in classroom reading, when she insists that there be silent reading, this is far more than simply a means of maintaining class discipline. And the child senses this, though he may not be able to articulate it. And it's a very difficult thing to read silently, and his legs twist around, and he bites down on his tongue, and he holds the pencil. But by an incredible tour de force, he learns how to turn on one sense and turn off the others. He will be indoctrinated in a world in which that sensory isolation is necessary. Now, at times, he may find the burden too great, and he will cast it off. And this is why we find that the insane are often called childlike, because they will orchestrate their senses. They will read aloud, or they will talk to themselves, like the child out in the garden, now I take this block, and so forth. And the child, when he thinks, he speaks. And when he speaks, he moves. And when he moves, he gestures, he dances. A silent reading was unknown in the Middle Ages. This podium was originally designed for a book. Which you stood in front of. In certain areas in European universities, they still stand to write. Sir James Fraser wrote all 54 volumes standing up. When they began to have clerks do this for them, they didn't lower the podium. They raised the chair. This is why the clerks were on those high stools at the... It was to come up rather than take the table down. I find it absolutely impossible to lecture sitting down. I can't do it. I can only lecture if I can move and if I can stand. Well, they could only read under those circumstances. Now, we have developed an entirely different mode of turning the entire body off. Of course, we never totally succeed in this. Physicians... throat surgeons warn that even silent reading involves muscles of the throat and so on. And when we dream, the eye moves. And there are many other indications that sensory, this concert of the senses is a natural, I use the word after some thought, a natural mode of expression. That to separate the senses is unnatural. And that when people find the burdens of literacy too great, they will cast them off. So that one of the curious marks of psychosis and neurosis in a literate society is the non-literate mode of experiencing reality. I spent the 3 years working on a project on the legal definition of insanity in California. And one of the fascinating things about it is that a person is judged to be legally insane when he perceives the values of literacy as given. That is, when he, if he thinks in a lineal fashion, if he sees things in rows and in lines, when in fact there are no rows and are no lines, but if he perceives and describes in this way, he's judged to be sane. But if he fails to see that which in fact is not there, then he's judged to be mentally wanting. Now, in a primitive society, we're going to find that there is no emphasis upon the senses, upon any single sense. It may be that somewhere up in the Himalayas or in some remote part of New Guinea there's a tribe that's gone kooky in one direction. But as far as I know, literate man is unique. He holds that distinction. It was he who said, one sense and one sense only. Plato proclaimed a hierarchy of senses with sight at the top and all other senses at the bottom. He said he placed touch at the bottom. But would a lover do this? And Aristotle tells us, as the first sentence of metaphysics, he must have regarded this as fairly crucial to start off on that foot. He says, of all the senses, trust only the sense of sight. And we have many phrases, seeing as believing, believe half of what you see and nothing of what you hear. The eyes of the Lord preserve knowledge, and he overthroweth the words of the transgressor. And truth, literate man believed, must be observed by the eye and then judged by the pronoun I. Mysticism, intuition, these are bad words among literate scientists. We can forgive a scientist anything. He can have an affair with the secretary, steal the stamp money, he can become a Communist Party member. Except one thing, he can't become mystical. When he does that, his colleagues turn against him. When Alfred Russel Wallace, whose contribution to the theory of natural selection was equal to that of Darwin, when he wrote a book on his notion of the descent of man, which incidentally is far closer to our current interpretations than Darwin's, and when he turned to phrenology, you know, studying the bumps on the head and the bumps on the bottom, as an indication of the personality of the person who owned that body, Thomas Huxley wrote to Darwin and said, "We must stop him. We must kill him if necessary." And one of Henry James, or William James's scientifically oriented colleagues told him that if William James were able to produce evidence of extrasensory perception, he would be inclined to suppress it in the interests of science. This notion of the use of senses in any other way than the one dictated by literacy, and curiously enough equated with a scientific method, so that the scientist really isn't describing the scientific method today, often. He's describing his notion of what it should be, but it's really literacy. I don't know about here, but in the universities where I've taught, psychologists always have a course on the scientific method. And it really consists of training students to put on a white coat and have their graduate students call them doctor, and to apply certain notions of objectivity, some weird thing they've come up with. And when you really do talk to a scientist about how he's made his great discovery, I remember Oppenheimer was asked by Edward Murrow, how does a physicist know that a thing is true? He said, "Oh, you know." He said, "A cold chill of fear goes down your spine, and you know." And really, well, what are you going to do with that? And when Lord Rutherford won the Nobel Prize, someone said, "How did you make that discovery?" And he said, "Well, I had a hunch." And Einstein, a friend of Einstein's wrote a book on Einstein's method, and he sent the manuscript to Einstein. And Einstein wrote back, he said, I'm sorry, it's not true. It was a fancy I had. And the scientists themselves, I'm also reminded of the discovery that led to the development of insulin. And Frederick Banning had this in a dream. He woke one night and he scribbled on a piece of paper, "Seal off the pancreas." And it turned out that he was so ignorant of the whole field that he didn't know that many people had tried to do it and failed. And so instead of consulting his colleagues who'd have nothing to do with him, he asked the local vet in a small Ontario town, say, "How would you seal off the pancreas?" And the vet knew how they'd been doing it with animals. And so he did what they'd done to animals to a human being, and it worked. But anyway, to get back to this question of sensory order, I think we've confused the literate, the sensory order of literate man, and we've called it the scientific method. Now, we know very little about this sort of thing, and as far as I know, no one has ever, no psychologist or physiologist has contributed much to the question of sensory ratios in any society. I suspect that when this is studied, we'll find that it's enormously complicated and enormously interesting. And I thought that today we might just make a pass at some of the insights that anthropology has offered in terms of how native peoples use their senses. Let's begin with one notion, and that is that in approaching reality or this outer nature experience, that is, when primitive man is away from his fellow man, he will use his senses with an intensity which to a city dweller appears awe-inspiring. Some of the earliest work done in anthropology was done on the Torres Strait expedition by Haddon and others about 80 years ago, and they found, to their amazement, that native peoples could see things at a distance which Westerners could not see. They could hear, they could smell. Their senses appeared to be more acute. And so the question immediately arose, was there a physiological difference? And it was the contribution of McDougall and Haddon and others. No, that it was a cultural factor. Now, this is true in tribes generally. I've seen Eskimos spot an airplane minutes before I could pick it up. And they'll stand watching it disappear long after it has gone off my horizon. Yeah, my eyes are 20/20. They could tell whether it was a seal or square flipper. They could spot things, they could hear things and smell things. But the interesting thing was, when they went back into the igloo, in the social setting, then they would go into another sensory order. Let me give you one quotation here from a Bedouin tribesman. A few days later, we passed some tracks. I was not even certain they were made by camels, for they were much blurred by the wind. Sultan turned to a gray-bearded man who was noted as a tracker and asked him whose tracks these were. And the man turned aside and followed them a short distance. He then jumped off his camel, looked at the tracks where they crossed some hard ground, broke some camel droppings between his fingers, and rode back to join us. Sultan asked, "Who were they?" And the man answered, "They were Aymar. There were six of them. They have raided the Kabuna on the south coast and taken three of their camels. They have come here from Suma and watered at Masa. They passed here 10 days ago." Some years ago, Spencer Chapman, a famous explorer, was kayaking along the southern coast of Greenland with an Eskimo party when suddenly dense fog reduced visibility to zero. The Eskimos continued without delay. They reached their destiny with complete accuracy. And the trick was very simple. They listened. They smelled. They felt. For example, they could pick up the sound of nesting birds along the coast, and they were familiar with every nesting area. They could pick up the pattern of the wave pattern as it was transmitted through the boat against their buttocks. They could smell the surf and the wind and all of these things. And under these circumstances, visibility meant nothing. What I'm suggesting to you is that when you orchestrate all of your senses, it is possible to remove one sense, even the sense of sight, and continue without any significant loss. I offer you a comparable case, a fascinating study made by a physician named, interestingly enough, Black, who worked with blind children. And he found that the art made by blind children, when he compared it to that of sighted children, was not significantly different down to the age of six, at which point the sighted children went off in the direction of optical imagery. Take a look at a child's painting sometime. It often has little to do with sight. I'm reminded of a sketch a Dutch boy made of a potato peel. He showed nothing that could be seen. The potatoes actually are under the ground. The tubers are hidden from view. He does not show you the green plant that's above. And this line around here is simply an imaginary line which encircles the potato field. The way children will use colors when they paint will be unrelated to the optical impression they receive. As a matter of fact, the children are not concerned primarily with optical imagery. Now, to city dwellers who mute their senses, the exploits of the so-called natural navigators appear uncanny. Harold Gaddy, the navigator, reports experiencing the fragrance of new mown hay 80 miles off the New Zealand coast in springtime. And Polynesian navigators are highly adept at identifying the odors and winds of sea currents, while desert dwellers can pick up a water hole, say, 6 miles away from the smell of a single camel. All of this might encourage us to believe that the native would then return to his tent or his igloo and continue to see and smell in this way. But the opposite is true. He will restrain his senses in social relations. He will achieve a sensory orchestration there by upping some and muting others. For example, ethnologists have found that in the field, it's good experience not to stare. When you talk to an informant, look off to one side. There's one section in Los Angeles, the Sunset Strip, where the hippies hang out. And I pass there several times a week. I drive down between the lines of them. And it reminds me very much of doing field work with native peoples. For one thing, when they talk together, one looks this way and one looks that way. And there's very little verbal communication, but there's a great deal of nonverbal communication. In native tribes, you find that in extreme case, this will be expressed as fear of the evil eye. But it's much more basic than that. And I think we'd be misled. We'd miss the whole point if we concerned ourselves with the superstitious element of it. The notion is simply this, that the eye is a transmitter, that the eye is a form of action, of power, that you turn the eye on, and when you do, it has the power, it has the power of a creative force. That the meeting of eyes will mix, and when they meet, something happens. That light emanating from an object will come and reach this eye, and this eye, in turn, will direct light, stick. This notion of a creative force that comes from the object means then that the native must restrain this force. He must cut the eye. He must cut the odors. This is why natives cover themselves with mud. Why? Not only to avoid being penetrated by odors elsewhere, but to prevent your own odor from entering someone else. It's why Arabs, for example, when they speak to friends, get up very close. They breathe on you. To deny another man your breath would be to deny him friendship. The Chukchi of Siberia will smell a person. When we meet, we shake hands. When they meet, they sort of plunge down one another's necks like this, and they smell. You draw back, and you drink in the essence of another person. It's the closest greeting there can be. Let me give you a few examples. I'm doing an awful. This is an awful monologue.
Why don't you come over here and we'll talk.
Yeah. Let's draw some of these.
Yeah. Bring the microphone. Okay. Harley, you want to? Does Marshall want to chat? Yeah. Yeah.
Some years ago, there came to my attention a remark that said, to the blind, all things are sudden, thereby raising into conscious thought the idea that to the sighted man, nothing was sudden. He had perspective. He was able to look forward. He was able to look behind. I think that one of my theses, ideas today is that under the impact of electric technology, there is very little possibility of perspective. We have no tendency, really, to look ahead. And this is certainly reflected in the whole art of this era. Perspective has totally vanished. Now, it's an interesting thing about perspective, in painting at least, and that is that the three-dimensional painting is a cul-de-sac. It is a proscenium arch stage, which you create as a painter. You create a space, and then in that space you put things in perspective. Now, contemporary painting, of course, is not concerned with this at all. It presents many facets of experience simultaneously. I know that in Europe, and particularly, it occurred to me first of all in Chartres Cathedral when I went in, I discovered that my whole sense of space was not governed by the visual elements of the cathedral at all. It was conditioned by the sound of my heels on the stones as I walked through it. this was the thing which gave me the sense of space. And I think that contemporary architecture is certainly moving into this. That is, that we are beginning, I believe, in this era, to use much more of our senses. I think this is reflected in all kinds of things. I'm a girl watcher, and I'm particularly conscious of the kind of tactility that has entered into the clothes of young women in the last 10, 15 years. There is a building in of other of the other senses. I think for 500 years we have thought that seeing is believing, as Dr. Carpenter mentioned. Incidentally, about seeing is believing, it's rather interesting because Leonardo da Vinci quoted it. He said, seeing is believing, but he neglected to quote the rest of it, which is a medieval text, actually. Seeing is believing, but to touch is the word of God.
Well, how much time is there? I forgot.
Yeah, we got 20 minutes.
There's so many items that Ted and Harley have brought up. I just want to mention a few that would interest you. That apple of the eye, for instance, is a scriptural phrase from the Psalms. Keep me in the apple of thine eye, says the psalmist. Meaning, presumably, keep me in the broadcasting center of the universe. Keep me on the air. That the eye of God, the apple of his eye, the broadcasting center or a station that creates the whole being of the universe. And that the eye was thought of as a broadcasting center until late in the 17th century. And it's until after Milton's time. A nice parallel or reverse of it, of course, is Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass. Instead of seeing space, when you go through the looking glass, you use all your senses. You don't just look at things anymore. When you go through the looking glass, you use movement, touch, hearing, everything to create the world you're in. So, actually, through the looking glass is the world of space-time, and Lewis Carroll got there about what? 50 years before Einstein. Lewis Carroll was a mathematician. He was fascinated by the new mathematics of non-Euclidean mathematics of Lobachevsky. Lobachevsky, back in 1820 or so, a Russian, brought up this world of non-visual mathematics. The world of number, by the way, is the world of touch. Not sight. And no work has been done at all in number theory as related to sensory life. But you know the whole experience of numbers is very different from the experience of letters. And that's one of the mysteries of currency, money. It's not related to sight so much as to the sense of touch and sound, the clink of money. When paper money came in, many people thought the bottom had fallen out of everything. Hard money was real money. Paper money was a terrifying collapse of the whole environment for many people back a century ago. But the change in the sensory life at the present time makes it very difficult for some of you people, for example, to read it, and very easy for you to do other things like math. And the highly visually oriented person has much trouble with mathematics. The less visually oriented people are much more at home with math. Euclid discovered geometry after literacy. It wasn't until well after literacy that Euclidean geometry was possible. Euclid alone had looked on beauty there as an asinine remark of, who's the poetess? St. Vincent de Lay. However, it isn't completely meaningless. But actually, what she was trying to say, that Euclid had created sculpture, a geometry of sculpture. In actual fact, he was the first to create visual mathematics. And this is a point that Artie Barker and I worked on a long time.
There is only one of our human senses that gives you an experience of continuity and connectedness and uniformity, repeatability, and that is sight. This has nothing to do with literacy. Of all the human senses, only one is continuous and connected. That's why that quote from the opening of Aristotle's Metaphysics is so important. To remember, Plato wrote over the door of his university, let nobody enter here who has not studied geometry. He meant this new discovery of Euclid, this visual space, this connected space, because this was the origin of reasoning. When the human faculty shifted to the visual sense, then what is called rational, connected, logical reasoning began. Logic has nothing to do with reason, with the human reason. It has very much to do with human vision, with the visual sense. And logic. Are new dimensions of space and time that relate to the electronic world. That's fun for me.
How about getting some people out there in this highly, this is a very old-fashioned visual room. Coppenberg is working on a big igloo for it.
Well, Bucky Fuller's dome is an igloo.
Yeah, Bucky Fuller's.
It's a primitive igloo, and Bucky doesn't know that. I know Bucky. In his conscious life, he's very literate. But in his artistic life, very primitive.
I have a curiosity. The sense of touch is what gives us the tri-dimensional. It seems curious to me that the primitives would have been strong in the sense of touch and would have been embedded in their consciousness. It didn't come out in their heart form at all.
Oh, I think it does.
I think it does.
I have to get out of here. Because they put their works on it, you can hear me? Because they put their works on museum on display and hit them with the spotlight and freeze them there statically, it doesn't mean that that's what the major intended. The African sculpture should be embraced. It has to be known by all of the senses. It makes no sense at all the way it's displayed in, like resident China. In our museum. And incidentally, let me warn you, or probably will forgive me, but don't trust museums. They have preserved this, you know, and then they put it down and they decontaminate these things and they're so careful about preservation. Then they bubble up everything when they display it. For example, most African masks have grass or weasel tails or something that hang down and cover the eyes. What's the first thing the curator does? He removes all of this so that you can see the wooden face underneath. Ah. And then these things were, the figures covered entire bodies. We just take one small plaque of the thing and they spoke. The eyes are closed on most of your masks, but the mouths are open or hinged. We put them frozen on a wall, silent. And then we talk about design and relationship to modern. That's a lot of work. The natives will take these things, and when they're not amused, they throw them away. They give them to anthropologists. A dog sleeps on the thing. These are not
Valley's Christ, we have no art. We do everything as well as possible.
So,
the primitive world, primitive art, is a very tactile thing. We've been grossly misled in this present presentation of art books. I'll give you just a few other examples to indicate it. In these art books, they put them on a flat surface, they sort of frame around them, they render them vertical. There's no verticality in most primitive art. You can have a native photograph upside down and they'll take it that way. He doesn't turn it around. We take these Paleolithic sketches and we'll isolate one image and we'll put all of the mastodon hooks here and the head here and so forth, so that when you go into a cave, and Lascaux and Altamira, you can't recognize them. We've been so biased by the misrepresentation in our educational system. It's like life generally, you know? It guarantees that we'll never be able to see the real thing from that point on.
I would say that one of the worst presentations I've ever seen, actually, is in your museum here in New York, the Museum of Primitive Art, where they do just exactly what Dr. Crawford was saying. They isolate these things as objet d'art, you know, the little spotlights on them. I think this is possibly one of the worst things you can do. I have, for myself, eliminated the word art. I dislike it intensely because the quality of its reception is that people immediately separate art off from all the other activities of man. I have another word which is also suspect, but I like it a little better, and that is creativity, which I believe should be pervasive through the whole of life. I can shake a man's hand creatively, or I can shake it destructively. This is art, if I'm creative about it. So I am, myself, dedicated to the concept that we have to make art a pervasive thing throughout the whole of life. Art itself, the making of a painting, the making of a piece of sculpture, or making of this or that, is purely a craft. Yes, we move on to the basis of interval. The fact that we now, in our concern with art, are not concerned with the nodal points of expression, but concerned very much with the interval between them. Cage wrote a book on music called Silence, which is a matter of concern about the interval between the events.
Silence means the total noise of the environment, because you never hear it. In Cage's book,
yeah.
All the sounds together of the environment equal silence, because they're totally inaudible. This is exactly what Ted is saying about native perception, that they take in the whole. One point, though, I thought this would be worth commenting on, and it's a point that Harley invented, as it were, or discovered, that touch is not the world of the connection. When you touch your leg or the table, anything, you create an interval. You do not create the connection. But the interval is something you have to close. That creates rhythm. All the stress of the Ephesians on rhythm comes from the world of touch. Touch creates interval, not connection. Then you close that creates rhythm. Now, in sculpture, it's not visual, it's tactile. And it's very close to music. Architecture is very close to music, same way. It's a world of touch. But very few people know that the sense of touch is the world of the interval, not of the connection. And it's like numbers. It's the world of touch. Numbers belong entirely in the world of touch. You count on your fingers or your toes. They create intervals, not connections. Visual is the only world of connection. Smell, no connection. Total discontinuity. Movement, entire discontinuity. But we'll go into this later, but I just wanted to bring up this extremely interesting point. You see, what's so exciting about this point, I think, is that it's totally unknown to the senior citizens and senior erudite people of our world. There isn't anybody, apart from you people right now, who know that the world of touch is the world of interval.
It's our secret.
Look at some of the phrases we use. Don't lose touch. Keep in touch. Keep in touch with.
I want to hold your hand.
But that creates interval too.
I would like to throw one point which I'd like you to think about. It is this. But during my career as a painter and as a designer, I have gone through many definitions of art, probably 150 or 200, given to me through various books of aesthetics and so on. I have come to one now, which for me is the best one I've ever come upon. It is not a definition of art, but it is this, that art is concerned with the illumination of the environment. That is its function. How it is done is another part of that definition. I won't go into it. But art is concerned with the illumination of the environment.
think about it. The making aware of the environment. Illumination is a visual term.
Oh, I'm sorry.
To get back to the tactile touch, we were talking before about numbers, and in mathematics, like how do they count you understand through a picture, but if you continue on into like linear algebra, you're dealing with vector spaces, you have, you're dealing, let's say, with a space that has four dimensions, and to me, we can't picture four dimensions, or six dimensions. But I was wondering if you could relate what you said about numbers and you understand tactically. I was wondering if you could relate that to a problem such as this. How does the sense of touch? I can't understand how that would have a tactile interpretation any more than you could interpret that.
Possible.
Yes?
Well, Mr. Parker just gave the answer here. Composites, all the senses at once. The touch is meeting point of all the senses, interface of all the senses at once.
Well, are you talking about touch and something more than just cutaneous contact?
There are various forms of touch, active and passive. Oh, yeah.
What can you explain that?
Well, it's not a simple thing to explain or expound, but mere passive touch, just a momentary touch or contact, that's passive. But most touch is very active. Exploratory and surrounding film. And the Europeans are often accused of using their eyes like hands. He undressed me with his eyes, a frequent complaint. The European, bedroom eyes means it's a popular expression in Europe, it's many years. Means simply eyes used as if they were all the senses at once. And in this, in North America, highly specialized sensory area, we use one sense at a time. Natives use all the senses at once. And that's touch. That's interference. And that's also metamorphosis. That is also change. Perpetual change resulting from this interface or touch of one thing on another. This is, of course, the meaning of that title, by the way. The medium is the massage. It means it touches, handles, changes, shapes. And each medium is one or another part of our human sensorium in action.
I have one example and one suggestion in terms of this hot and cool medium. Dr. McClellan suggested that the telephone is a cool medium. It's very hard to hear on it, so you use up almost all of your energy just getting the signal, and you, in using up this energy, you repress your visual sense. You don't have any energy left over for visualizing, and therefore, if you wanted to communicate insights about six-dimensional space, the big enemy of understanding six-dimensional space is your visual sense. That one interesting way to do it would be to do it by telephone, which as a medium would repress the visual and concentrate the energy just on the idea of having a microphone.
Just as an experiment, when telephoning next time, see whether you can visualize by or imagine the person you're speaking to. And then just send in a little report, will you, about 20 words on that a piece, because you won't all have the same experience, but it'll be interesting.